Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian fighter jets intercepted a U.S. drone over the Black Sea Tuesday, leading the operators of the MQ-9 Reaper drone to bring it down in international waters. The U.S. military says it downed the drone after its propeller was struck by a Russian jet. Russia denies making contact with the drone, which it said was gathering intelligence to help Ukraine attack Russia, and said it had entered a prohibited area near Crimea. If a collision is confirmed, it would be the first known contact between the U.S. and Russian military since the start of the Ukraine war. We'll have more on the implications of this, as well as the latest reports on the Nord Stream pipeline blow-up, after headlines with The Intercept's Jeremy Scahill. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced a bill to repeal the Trump-era rollback of the Dodd-Frank Act following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. The bill brings the threshold for banks that must undergo extra federal regulations back down to at least $50 billion in assets. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon's released video of what it says is a Russian fighter jet forcing down a U.S. surveillance drone over the Black Sea Tuesday. The 42-second video shows an Su-27 Russian fighter jet pouring fuel on an MQ-9 Reaper drone and making a pair of close passes. After the second flyby, the video glitches before revealing damage to the drone's propeller. The U.S. says a collision caused the drone to crash into international waters south of the Russian-annexed Ukrainian territory of Crimea. On Wednesday, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said he called his Russian counterpart to discuss the incident.
So make no mistake, the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows.
Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu reportedly told Austin U.S. drone flights near Crimea are provocative and could lead to an escalation between Russian and U.S. forces. In Moscow, the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said Russia had designated parts of the Black Sea off limits to any aerial traffic during Russia's military operations in Ukraine.
You have heard representatives of the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs of Staff say that the United States will continue to fly wherever it pleases in accordance with international law. But if you follow this logic, then the space around the United States has the same status as the space over the Black Sea.
In Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin welcomed Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad to the Kremlin earlier today. Assad said he welcomed a Russian proposal to set up new military bases in Syria and said Damascus has agreed to recognize Russia's annexation claims over occupied parts of Ukraine. Stock markets in Asia have tumbled after Credit Suisse Bank signaled it'll borrow up to $54 billion from Switzerland's central bank. The bailout pushed European markets higher after investors fled Credit Suisse and other financial stocks a day earlier amidst fears the sudden collapse of U.S. banks SVB and Signature might trigger a wider financial crisis. In another sign of turmoil in the banking sector, shares of San Francisco-based First Republic Bank have fallen by nearly three quarters over the past week after ratings firms downgraded the bank's credit rating to junk. Meanwhile, Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Richard Blumenthal have asked the Biden administration to launch a criminal probe into whether SVB executives violated civil or criminal law ahead of the bank's collapse last week. In a letter to the Securities and Exchange Commission and Attorney General Merrick Garland, the senators write, quote, one of the enduring failures in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis was the inability or unwillingness of the Justice Department and bank regulators to hold bank executives accountable for behavior that destroyed millions of lives and cost trillions of dollars of wealth. The nation's bank regulators cannot make the same mistake twice, they wrote. In Texas, a federal judge heard arguments Wednesday in a case that could restrict medication abortions throughout the country, revoking the FDA's two-decade-old approval of mifepristone, which is the most common abortion method in the U.S. Demonstrators rallied outside the courthouse in Amarillo. This is activist Janda Raker.
It feels very...
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A
essential workers who kept families, societies, and economies going while the world was on COVID lockdown need better pay and conditions urgently if countries are to future-proof themselves from the next global crisis, UN labor experts said on Wednesday. According to a new report from the International Labour Organization, ILO, drawing on data from 90 countries, key workers remain severely undervalued and their contributions insufficiently recognized. The study focuses on workers in sectors such as health, retail, food systems, security, sanitation, and transport. ILO's findings show that during the COVID-19 crisis, these key workers suffered higher mortality rates than others because of their greater exposure to the coronavirus. Many essential workers also continue to earn less than two-thirds of the average wage. Here's Richard Sammons, Director of ILO's Research Department.
This is an opportunity for obtaining a two-for-one payoff for both improving the working conditions, reducing the social justice deficits faced by many of these categories of workers, but also for strengthening the resilience of economies, their ability to withstand shocks of whatever nature, whether it be a future pandemic, a natural disaster, or other.
As the Syrian conflict officially enters its 13th year on Wednesday, top UN humanitarian leaders stressed that the country remained one of the world's most complex humanitarian and protection emergencies. More than 15 million people across Syria need humanitarian assistance this year, the highest number since the start of the conflict, said the UN aid coordinators for Syria and the region, El-Mustafa Ben Lamli and Mohamed Hadi. In addition, 6.8 million are displaced inside the country, and roughly the same number live as refugees outside Syria. The humanitarian officials said that millions of Syrians were being pushed to the brink of survival amid a collapse of basic services, an ongoing cholera outbreak, increasing food and energy prices, and an economic crisis. The 6 February earthquakes only compounded this suffering, affecting an estimated 8.8 million people in the country. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Herr Pedersen, said that in the aftermath of the earthquakes, there was now a collective humanitarian imperative to depoliticize relief efforts in terms of access and resources. Officials in many countries vilify and target human rights defenders instead of recognizing their crucial work, which helps build fairer societies, a UN-appointed independent expert said on Wednesday. In a report to the Human Rights Council, Special Rapporteur Mary Lawler said that states can and should do more to protect defenders. The experts stressed that 25 years after states agreed on a declaration to promote and protect the work of human rights defenders, their contributions were often ignored. The expert also reminded the Council that in 1998, the Declaration on Human Rights Defenders was adopted by consensus, and they had all agreed to respect and implement it. Ms. Lawler highlighted the challenging circumstances in which human rights defenders operated worldwide.
That is exactly because defenders peacefully confront powerful vested interests, because they expose corruption, because they refuse to accept injustice, because they challenge criminal gangs, because they talk about issues that governments want to hide, and because they tell the truth, and because they make good things happen, that they are attacked.
Despite these challenges, rights activists have achieved positive change, the Special Rapporteur noted, including in changing legislation, getting people released from prison, or calling out corruption. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon's released video of what it says is a Russian fighter jet forcing down a U.S. surveillance drone over the Black Sea Tuesday. The 42-second video shows an Su-27 Russian fighter jet pouring fuel on an MQ-9 Reaper drone and making a pair of close passes. After the second flyby, the video glitches before revealing damage to the drone's propeller. The U.S. says a collision caused the drone to crash into international waters south of the Russian-annexed Ukrainian territory of Crimea. On Wednesday, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said he called his Russian counterpart to discuss the incident.
So make no mistake, the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows.
Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu reportedly told Austin U.S. drone flights near Crimea are provocative and could lead to an escalation between Russian and U.S. forces. In Moscow, the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said Russia had designated parts of the Black Sea off limits to any aerial traffic during Russia's military operations in Ukraine.
You have heard representatives of the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs of Staff say that the United States will continue to fly wherever it pleases in accordance with international law. But if you follow this logic, then the space around the United States has the same status as the space over the Black Sea.
In Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin welcomed Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad to the Kremlin earlier today. Assad said he welcomed a Russian proposal to set up new military bases in Syria and said Damascus has agreed to recognize Russia's annexation claims over occupied parts of Ukraine. Stock markets in Asia have tumbled after Credit Suisse Bank signaled it'll borrow up to $54 billion from Switzerland's central bank. The bailout pushed European markets higher after investors fled Credit Suisse and other financial stocks a day earlier amidst fears the sudden collapse of U.S. banks SVB and Signature might trigger a wider financial crisis. In another sign of turmoil in the banking sector, shares of San Francisco-based First Republic Bank have fallen by nearly three quarters over the past week after ratings firms downgraded the bank's credit rating to junk. Meanwhile, Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Richard Blumenthal have asked the Biden administration to launch a criminal probe into whether SVB executives violated civil or criminal law ahead of the bank's collapse last week. And a letter to the Securities and Exchange Commission and Attorney General Merrick Garland, the senators write, quote, one of the enduring failures in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis was the inability or unwillingness of the Justice Department and bank regulators to hold bank executives accountable for behavior that destroyed millions of lives and cost trillions of dollars of wealth. The nation's bank regulators cannot make the same mistake twice, they wrote. In Texas, a federal judge heard arguments Wednesday in a case that could restrict medication abortions throughout the country, revoking the FDA's two-decade-old approval of mifepristone, which is the most common abortion method in the U.S. Demonstrators rallied outside the courthouse in Amarillo. This is activist Janda Raker.
It feels very discouraging. It feels like we have gone back in history. When I was a young mother in 1962, they were just starting to let women take the pill. And so now we've come to abortions have been legal since 73, and now they're not.
In Israel, hundreds of thousands of people continue to protest in the streets after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu forged ahead with plans to upend Israel's system of checks and balances by gutting the power of the judiciary. In Jerusalem, thousands block roads outside the country's Supreme Court. Elsewhere, protesters took over a Tel Aviv highway, among dozens of other disruptions in cities and towns nationwide. The renewed protests came after Netanyahu rejected a compromise proposal to defuse the crisis put forward by Israel. Israel's President Isaac Herzog, who warned in a televised address that Israel stands on the brink of civil war.
Whoever thinks that a true civil war, where human life is at stake, is a border we won't reach, has no clue specifically now in the 75th year of the State of Israel. The abyss is at arm's reach.
Meanwhile, tensions between Israel and Lebanon rose after Israel's army said it killed an armed man who entered northern Israel and set off a car bomb Monday, severely injuring an Israeli civilian. Israel's military says it was investigating whether Hezbollah fighters from Lebanon were behind the blast. In Indonesia, indigenous people say construction of the new national capital is pushing them off their land, making them fear for their homes and livelihoods as the nation prepares to move its seat of government from Jakarta to the east coast of the island of Borneo. Nusantara is set to be inaugurated as Indonesia's new capital next summer. In 2019, President Joko Widodo announced the move away from Jakarta, which is rapidly sinking into the Java Sea. This is Balik tribal chief Sabudkin.
There's a large forest area in the new capital's construction zone, which used to be an arable land and the livelihood of our people. We are not hoping that it will be given back to us, but please do not disturb what we are left with, where we have been living for years. We've had enough. We've had to give in, and we can't let this be taken too.
The Indonesian government has pledged to build a sustainable carbon-neutral city, but environmentalists warn its construction will lead to massive deforestation threatening endangered species. The Biden administration's approved a $31 billion merger between Canadian Pacific Railway and Kansas City Southern, the first major rail merger approved by U.S. regulators in more than 20 years. The new company, named Canadian Pacific Kansas City, will operate freight rail traffic over more than 20,000 miles of track in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. The merger brings the number of major U.S. rail firms down to six. It follows February's derailment of a freight train in Ohio that spread toxic chemicals across the town of East Palestine. This week, the Inter-Union Coalition Railroad Workers United passed a resolution opposing the merger, noting that rail industry consolidation has resulted in less competition, fewer jobs, severe traffic congestion, dissatisfied shippers, delayed passenger trains, and serious safety concerns. Michigan lawmakers have voted to overturn an anti-union law approved by state Republicans in 2012. Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer has promised to sign legislation which will make Michigan the first state in nearly 60 years to roll back a so-called right-to-work law. Since the law took effect, Michigan unions have seen a decline of about 40,000 members. 26 other U.S. states still have right-to-work policies in place. In Georgia, special grand jurors investigating interference in the 2020 election have heard audio of a phone call Trump placed to then-House Speaker David Ralston, in which the president asked the fellow Republican to convene a special session of the legislature to overturn Joe Biden's Electoral College victory in Georgia. That's according to new details of the grand jury's probe published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which reports Speaker Ralston responded to Trump, "I will do everything in my power that I think is appropriate." Ralston did not call a special session, and Biden's win in Georgia was ultimately certified despite Trump's efforts. In January of 2021, Trump was recorded asking Georgia's Republican Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes enough to overtake Joe Biden. Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis said in January a decision whether to bring criminal charges against Trump is imminent. The U.S. Senate narrowly confirmed former Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti as ambassador to India Wednesday, more than 600 days after his nomination, and despite reports Garcetti was aware his former deputy chief of staff, Rick Jacobs, was guilty of sexual harassment. A handful of Republicans joined the majority of Democrats to secure the confirmation after several Democratic senators came out against Garcetti. Earlier this week, Naomi Seligman, former communications director for then-Mayor Eric Garcetti, spoke out against her former boss on CNN.
Predators can only continue to abuse when you have a powerful enabler. And Eric Garcetti is a very powerful enabler, and he is about to become more powerful. We have a situation where he would oversee 2,000 or more employees, and he has not shown the judgment. He is unfit to become an ambassador or really to hold public office anywhere in this country or this world.
Texas officials announced Wednesday they're taking over Houston's nearly 200,000 student public school district, citing poor academic performance and mismanagement. It's one of the largest school takeovers ever in the United States and comes as an affront to state Democrats and many families in Houston, where 90% of the student body is of color, primarily Black and Latinx. It's the latest example of largely white and Republican state officials across the U.S. trying to take control over majority non-white cities. And in San Francisco, the city's Board of Supervisors accepted recommendations for a reparations plan that would offer $5 million to each eligible African-American resident, among other measures. It was just one of many steps on the way to making reparations a reality for Black San Franciscans, but offered new hope for the movement, which regained traction following the 2020 uprising for racial justice. On Tuesday, backers of the reparations plan spoke at the board hearing, including Black police officer Yolanda Williams.
When my parents migrated here from Louisiana to San Francisco, it was for a hope and a dream that they would be treated fairly and equally. And for them to have had to witness the racial disparity that I received in this city as a peace officer was absolutely atrocious. It is time for you to do the right thing and provide us with the reparations. Make us whole. Make us important in your lives. Black lives matter.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law & Disorder, we're joined by Zachary Sklar, an Oscar-nominated film writer and former editor of The Nation.
Screenwriter and journalist Zachary Sklar grew up in Hollywood as a child of the blacklist. His new book, titled The Work, a Jigsaw Memoir. And then we'll also be joined by a professor who runs the Albany Law School Immigration Clinic, talking to us about the exploitation of unaccompanied minor immigrants into the United States.
It's a disgrace and a shame what big American corporations are doing to these young children.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Screenwriter and journalist Zachary Sklar grew up in Hollywood as, in his words, a child of the blacklist. His fine book, The Work, a Jigsaw Memoir, has just been published. We will speak with him today. In the 1950s, Zach's father, George Sklar, a playwright and screenwriter, was blacklisted from the movie industry for his past membership in the Communist Party. His mother, Miriam Blecker, was a modern dancer in the Martha Graham Company and a founding director of the New Dance Group. During the McCarthy era, many of their friends were hauled in front of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, called HUAC. Several of them fled the country. Others were imprisoned. As a result, Zach grew up in an atmosphere of all-pervasive fear. Richard Nixon rode to power on fear. After he retired, a reporter asked him what his secret to political success was. He replied instantly, "It was fear, fear, and they don't teach you that in the Boy Scouts." Zach's beautiful collection of personal essays tells his story of how he overcame the fear he experienced as a child growing up in Hollywood during the blacklist years. Zachary Sklar is a writer, editor, and a teacher. A graduate of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, he has taught magazine writing at that institution and also has served as the executive editor of The Nation magazine. Zach Sklar edited several books about the CIA for Sheridan Square Press, including Ari Ben-Menashe's Prophets of War and the New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's best-selling On the Trail of the Assassins, which makes the case that the CIA was behind the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Zach later co-wrote with Oliver Stone the Oscar-nominated screenplay for the movie JFK. He's been a creative advisor at the Sundance Screenwriting Labs for more than two decades and currently teaches screenwriting for the Harlem Dramatic Writing Workshop in New York. Zach Sklar was a friend of our show's co-founder, Michael Ratner, and edited Michael's memoir, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. Zach Sklar, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Zach, tell us about your parents. What was it like growing up in Hollywood during the blacklist years and how you overcame the fear you grew up with?
Well, my parents were communists, like a lot of people during the Depression, the great crisis of capitalism. They joined the Communist Party in New York, and then they moved to L.A. in the 40s, and my father was a screenwriter, and they eventually left the Communist Party because my father didn't like being told by commissars what to write and what not to write. But in 1947, a freshman congressman named Richard Nixon on the House Un-American Activities Committee figured out that he could make a very big splash by accusing people in the film industry of being communists. And that made his career. And so they, HUAC had hearings, and people who were summoned, 10 of them decided to refuse to testify because they were being asked to reveal things that were protected by the First Amendment, their associations, that, you know, people, the names of people who were in the Screenwriters Guild with them, whether they belonged to a Communist Party, which of course was at that time a perfectly legal party, did not advocate a violent overthrow of the government. It was, you know, they were in presidential elections and so forth. And my parents were no longer members of the party, but that didn't really matter. The name of this game was get publicity for Richard Nixon and feed the anti-communist hysteria which followed World War II. Apparently, those who had recognized that World War had saved capitalism realized that they needed an enemy to keep it going. And so they found communism. And what happened was, when this committee came, if you refused to name names and admit that you were in the Communist Party, you would be blacklisted. And that's what happened to my father. He was named three times before the committee. And the committee didn't allow you to have any rebuttal. There were no, you know, rules of law that applied. And so what happened was that people who were named lost their jobs. And worse, my father's collaborator on two plays, Albert Maltz, was one of the Hollywood Ten. He was imprisoned for contempt of Congress when he refused to testify. So the result of all this was that several of my parents' friends moved to Europe to avoid the blacklist. Others were imprisoned. Others had heart attacks. And everybody lost their jobs. So the fear that was around when I was growing up was pervasive. And the other thing that was pervasive was secrecy, because of course we were told not to discuss our political beliefs with anybody in school. There was just a feeling of hysteria in the country. You know, my parents felt that they had been damaged enough. They didn't want us to jeopardize our own lives, their kids. So they told us not to sign anything, not to get involved with any political movements, not to have our photographs taken. All that was fear. And basically, I lived with that all the way up until the late 60s. Blacklist actually ended in around 1960. But my father had withdrawn during that period. He'd lost his courage. And that was the example I got. And it took me going to college at UC Santa Cruz and getting involved with the anti-war movement, which I realized was millions of people. It wasn't just a handful of screenwriters under siege, which was what the blacklist had been. It was millions of people in the streets, and I joined them. And at the same time, I was the civil rights movement was going on. Martin Luther King was killed in 1968, and I had an opportunity to go to Dufusky Island in South Carolina, which was, you know, a very small island with no bridge, populated by about 100 black people who were living in a different century. And during this time when I went there, I was exposed to tremendously courageous people who'd lived through all kinds of things during the Jim Crow years, and also to a white doctor named Dr. Donald Gatch, who testified before a congressional committee that 80% of the black kids he treated were suffering from worms and malnutrition, and they ran him out of town and brought lawsuits against him. And so, I mean, I started to get... You asked how I overcame fear, and the answer is every time I was afraid, I realized that's exactly what I should try to resist and go for it. And that's what I did when I went to the anti-war movement and when I went to Dufusky Island. And when I saw the example of these people who had stood up and resisted, and that was so different from the example I'd had from my parents during the blacklist years.
Mm-hmm. Sklar, Jim Lafferty here, and I'm mostly finished now with your wonderful book titled, by the way, The Work, A Jigsaw Memoir. And thinking of your chapter in the book, in which you talk about Attorney Bill Schapp, the National Lawyers Guild member, whom we interviewed, frankly, on this show before, and his companion, Ellen Ray. Remind us of who those two people are, and what was your relationship with them, and what kind of work did you do with them?
Well, Bill Schapp, I used to edit a magazine called The Juris Doctor, which was a magazine for young lawyers. This was back in the 1970s. And Bill Schapp was, at that time, the editor of the Military Law Reporter. Bill had been doing military law during the Vietnam War, counseling GIs who were resisting the war, and he'd become quite an authority on all this. So he wrote an article for Juris Doctor about military law, and I hadn't met Bill. I just corresponded with him because he was living in Washington and I was in New York. But we met later, and Bill and Ellen decided to move to New York and start a publishing house called Sheridan Square Press. It turned out that I didn't know this at the time, but Bill and Ellen were publishers of a magazine called Covert Action Information Bulletin, along with a man named Lou Wolf. And that Covert Action became a quarterly, and it actually still exists today. It's online. Lou Wolf has kept it going. But they were public enemy number one for the CIA, because the whole purpose of Covert Action Information Bulletin was to expose the nefarious activities of the CIA all over the world. And in doing so, they had figured out a way to name agents who were masquerading as embassy officials in various countries. So they named them. But of course, the way that repression works is that the law is used to silence people, just as it had been during the blacklist years. And what happened was that Congress passed the Intelligence Identities Protection Act to stop Bill and Ellen from naming those names, in which they did. They stopped doing it, so they weren't arrested. In fact, the only person ever prosecuted under that law was Scooter Libby, who was a chief of staff to Dick Cheney later in the Valerie Plame case. But the idea was that they could be silenced. But the thing is, Bill and Ellen couldn't be silenced. They were very courageous people, and they started this publishing house, and I edited four books for them. So the first of the four books that I edited for Sheridan Square Press was Ralph McGeehee's book, which was about his time in the CIA, 25 years, where he worked for the CIA in Vietnam, in Thailand, in the Philippines, and in Indonesia. They didn't let him actually mention Indonesia. That was one of the things they censored. But that was the first of the books, and the most publicized book was the book by Jim Garrison, who's the former district attorney of New Orleans, who had written a book about the Kennedy assassination. This was 25 years after, and Garrison had continued his investigation long after he'd been out of office. So Jim Garrison had written this book for a mainstream press, and then when he finished it, they rejected the book, and Jim was convinced that the CIA had intervened at the top. So through a mutual friend, Mary Howell, a National Lawyers Guild member in New Orleans, he got the book to Bill and Ellen, and they gave it to me to edit as an objective history. And I realized, although it was a very well-researched book and source-noted and all that, it wouldn't fly as a objective history, because Jim was a significant player in the whole affair. He was the only authority to bring a case in the Kennedy assassination. So I told him that, and he didn't want to have the spotlight be on him personally. But I convinced him by saying, look, if you can show people how you went from being he was hardly a radical. From being a guy who had been an officer in World War II, he'd been in the military for 23 years, he'd been a major city district attorney, he'd been in the FBI. He was not a radical by any means. And when he first heard about the Kennedy assassination, he believed the Warren Report. But then, as he looked into it, he realized that it wasn't what he thought. And so I said to him, if you can take people step by step through the evidence that convinced you that this was not a lone assassin, that the CIA was behind this, they will go with you. And he bought that, and he said, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it first person, and it won't be a who done it, it will be a why done it. And then he wrote that book, and then that book was not, didn't get much attention. It basically, Garrison had been successfully censored in this country. They had done a real number on him. The CIA had put out a memo saying how you slander critics of the Warren Commission, which at the time were Mark Lane and Jim Garrison were the two most prominent. And they had, in effect, neutralized him by saying he was this gothic Southern politician, he was corrupt, he believed his lies and all this kind of thing, all the stuff that was written about him. When the book came out, it was greeted with a great silence. Nobody really paid much attention to it. But Ellen Ray met Oliver Stone in an elevator in Havana at the film festival and handed him the book and said, you should make a movie out of this book. And Oliver Stone, just to get rid of her, basically said, promised to read it. And he did read it. And he called up later, and he was on the way to Asia to film Born on the 4th of July. And he said, I want to make this movie, but I'm busy and I need, who can help me? And they said, well, Zach's been working on the book for 2 years. He knows it backwards and forwards. And so Oliver Stone hired me. I'd never written a movie before, but Oliver Stone hired me over the phone, and I wrote the first draft of what became the film JFK. It went back and forth to Oliver. He was the co-writer and the director. And it went back and forth for, about a dozen drafts and, many, many interviews and a lot of work. But eventually it came out, and it became the film JFK. So that was, Bill and Ellen, were responsible for that. They were the people who were courageous enough to publish that book. And they did that throughout their lives. And my work with them, then after that, they published other books. They published a book by Eri Ben-Menashe called Prophets of War, which was, just a mind-boggling book. I edited that also. And they published Lies of Our Times, which is a magazine about the New York Times and all the errors that they would print. They were like a watchdog publication. And so they made a major contribution, I thought, to, our knowledge of what was really going on behind the scenes. They were, I would say, for that era, they were the equivalent of what Julian Assange is now. Julian Assange has exposed the CIA and all of the U.S. government machinations just because he has the ability to do that technically, because he could get it on the Internet. Bill and Ellen didn't have that ability then, but they were trying to do exactly the same thing. But again, the law is used as a tool of repression to silence those kinds of people, that kind of dissent. And that's why we have Julian Assange in prison today. Even though he publishes exactly the same thing that the New York Times publishes, their Spiegel publishes, and all these major papers that co-published with him, none of those have been prosecuted, but Julian Assange has been in prison for years now.
This is your co-host on Law and Disorder Radio, Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Zachary Sklar, who has just written the wonderful memoir, The Work, a Jigsaw Memoir. Zach, I just wanted to compliment you. I've read the book. It's terrific. And I wanted to read for our listeners a couple of sentences that Oliver Stone, the multiple Oscar-winning writer-director, wrote about one of the essays. Oliver said, "The essay Bill and Ellen versus the CIA is a most moving portrait of the love affair between Bill Shapp and Ellen Ray, publishers of some of the most revolutionary books in American history about our covert operations, as told by my co-author on JFK. Zach, I wanted to ask you about your close friend Bill Rubin. He was an investigative journalist who wrote two explosive books during the 1950s, The Adams Spy Hoax, about the Rosenberg case, and The Honorable Mr. Nixon, an ironic title, about the Alger Hiss case. Alger Hiss helped found the United Nations after World War II and was its first Secretary General. In the late 1940s, he was accused by then-freshman Congressman Richard Nixon of being a Soviet spy and was convicted of perjury in a highly publicized case that marked the beginning of the McCarthy era. Rubin was writing a new in-depth book about the Hiss case based on 200,000 FBI documents he and Hiss got under the Freedom of Information Act, and you were editing that book. But Rubin died before it could come out. Zach, can you please tell us about Alger Hiss and Bill Rubin?
Well, Alger Hiss is not remembered very well these days, but back in 1947, about the same time that the blacklist was starting because of the accusations that Richard Nixon brought to Hollywood, he also brought accusations against Alger Hiss. Alger Hiss was sort of the ultimate New Deal statesman. He'd been in the State Department for many years. After the war, he had become, he'd worked to found the United Nations. He was the president of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. He was like a New Deal liberal, and I think the intent of Richard Nixon and the anti-communist hysteria of the time was to create an atmosphere of war, an ongoing atmosphere of war. I think that was the goal, to have an enemy that so that we could keep the capitalist economy going by with defense spending. So the way that Nixon did it is he found a character named Whitaker Chambers, who was a self-confessed perjurer, and they came up with accusations that Alger Hiss had somehow, when he was in the State Department, been a Soviet spy. And to prove this, they found some microfilm that was in a pumpkin in the farm that Whitaker Chambers had. It turned out, of course, that these microfilms showed absolutely nothing of any military or diplomatic interest. But at the time, these were all kept secret, and Nixon would have press conferences and have piles of documents in front of him, none of which anybody ever looked at, and effectively discredited Alger Hiss. And the intent was to discredit the New Deal and say the New Deal equaled liberal, liberal equaled spy, and spy equaled traitor. And that was really the intent of it. And Hiss was tried. There was a lot of publicity, and he ultimately was not convicted of espionage. Just as, you know, this is the same thing they're doing with Julian Assange now. They accuse him of espionage when there is no espionage. It's just a way of having the law intimidate people and put them in fear. They make an example out of someone. So they did that with Alger Hiss. So this playbook of what they're doing to Julian Assange is an old playbook. And what happened was that Alger Hiss went through two trials. First one was a hung jury. And it was not about espionage. It was about perjury. Ultimately, they said he had denied that he was in the Communist Party, which I don't think he ever was. But anyway, in any event, his second trial, he was found guilty of perjury, and he actually did go to prison. So just as Julian Assange is going to prison today, this is an old story. And a lot of the stuff that has come out in those 200,000 pages of documents that Bill Rubin and Alger Hiss sued for under the Freedom of Information Act have revealed that, well, a hoax the whole thing was, that Nixon and Whitaker Chambers had really cooked up this thing. And Bill Rubin, who had grown up with a bunch of charlatans and con men. His father was a con man, and he had been in prison himself, and he knew a lot of con men. He grew up around Damon Runyon and that group, you know, the guys and dolls kind of people. And so he knew a con man when he saw one, and he said he spotted them immediately, that Nixon and Chambers and J. Edgar Hoover, these were all con men, and they were just on a much bigger stage than Bill had grown up with his father's con men. So, but he recognized them for what they were.
Zach, you were, of course, good friends with Michael Ratner, the radical attorney who co-founded our radio show, Law and Disorder. You edited, in fact, his memoir entitled My Life as a Radical Lawyer. Please talk to us about Michael Ratner.
Well, Michael was a great man. I mean, he was a great lawyer, and he was a very important example for me. The book was actually called Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, and those, you know, who are regular listeners to this program know Michael's work well. I mean, he had been raised in a Jewish family in Cleveland, a liberal family. He ended up going to Columbia University to law school, where he was radicalized during the 1968 rebellion there, and he went on to work with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He then worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights and became president of that organization, and brought many, many important lawsuits, particularly about what was going on in Central America in the 1980s, in Nicaragua, El Salvador, trying to stop the U.S. aggression in those places, and in Cuba. Michael Smith can certainly tell you about co-authoring his book about the murder of Che Guevara. Michael was a really important force for good in this world, and his book is well worth reading. The range of what he did is just astonishing.
Zach Sklar, you've just had published your wonderful book, The Work, A Jigsaw Memoir. Zach, is there an underlying theme in your book about Schaap and Ray and Garrison and Rubin and Stone? If there is an underlying theme, I think that would be that they were fearless people. And I wanted to ask you, how did their example affect you?
Well, having grown up during the Blacklist and really, you know, having the osmosis of fear, you know, just pervade my life, my exposure to these people really emboldened me to see that there were people out there who were not afraid to confront authority, to confront power, and did it with great humor and fun, and were able to live their lives and not live in fear. That was eye-opening for me, and also it changed my life. I mean, I was able to work with these people, and they gave me strength. I did what I could with them. And also, one of the other people in there should be Dr. Gatch, who I watched when I was very young when I was on Dufusky Island. But all those people, Bill Schaap, Ellen Ray, Jim Garrison, Bill Rubin, Oliver Stone, they're all courageous people. And I think when you feel isolated, as my parents did during the Blacklist, you lose your courage. And I think when you are around people who are courageous, it emboldens you and to do what you need to do and what you feel is the right thing to do. And that's how it affected me. They stirred my sense of outrage at what was wrong with this society, and they gave me the courage to speak out. And I think that's what we all need to do if we're going to change things.
Fear has been resurrected again today. For 4 years, Trump stoked fear of Muslims, fear of immigrants, fear of people of color. He hopes to ride back into office on the back of a campaign using fear of socialism. He's already started that. Last month, the newly elected Republican Congress, heavily influenced by Trump, spent days fashioning a House resolution condemning socialism in all its forms. Do you think that fear theme will be the theme in our country for the next period?
Well, I think fear always needs an enemy. As you pointed out in the Nixon quote at the beginning of the program, that's the basis of some of these politicians' success, is getting people to be afraid. And so they need an enemy. In this case, socialism is a tried and true enemy. They have done this since post-war World War II. They started with the anti-socialist, anti-communist theme, and they've kept it up. I mean, they've varied it a little bit by having fear of immigrants, fear of, you know, of people of color, and fear of Muslims and terrorists and so forth. But they always keep coming back to socialism, because socialism offers an alternative to a capitalist economy that's based on a constant state of war, and that's what we've been in since World War II. So I think it's very possible we'll be hearing a lot about that, and I would urge people, from my own experience, don't give in to fear. Fear is a bad way to live, and it's a bad motivation for acting in the world. You know, you should act on what you really believe and go for it, and don't let your fear dictate your life.
Absolutely, and I want to say I think that comes through in your wonderful book, Loud and Clear. And in fact, I wanted to ask you, if folks who are listening, I would encourage them to get a hold of your book, which is called The Work, A Jigsaw Memoir. But how do they go about doing that?
The best way to do it is, the book is available online. You can order through Amazon, through bookshop.org, or through Barnes & Noble. It's on demand. Or you can ask your local book store to order it through our distributor, which is Ingram. And I just wanted to say that the title, The Work, comes from an Allen Ginsberg quote, which was, well, it's from a poem called Memory Gardens. It says, while I'm here, I guess I'll do the work. And what's the work? To ease the pain of living. Everything else, drunken dumb show. And so I view the work, and I interpret that to mean not just a Band-Aid or taking a placebo or a drug to ease the pain of living. I take that to mean, in a broader context, doing all we have to do to change the context and change the social norms so that people are not suffering, so that the pain of living is eased. And that's our job, and that's the work.
Thank you so much, not only for this wonderful book and for all of your work, which is beautifully chronicled in the book, but of course on a much more modest scale, we sure as hell thank you for joining us here on Law and Disorder too, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The New York Times headline in its February 25th edition says it all, and I quote, "Alone and exploited, migrant children work brutal jobs across the U.S., close quote. Yes, last year, 130,000 unaccompanied minors entered the United States. And last year, the federal agency responsible for placing these children in suitable situations as their cases are processed lost track of at least 85,000 of them. But we know where all too many of them can be found. Working 10 to 12 hours a day in violation of our nation's child labor laws in the American supply chain for many major brands and retailers, retailers like Ford and General Motors, retailers like Walmart and General Mills, whose brands include Cheerios, Lucky Charms, and Nature Valley, and PepsiCo, which owns Frito-Lay and Quaker Oats. And the list goes on and on. And so underage children here in the United States and needing to earn money to send to their destitute families back home or pay off the smuggler who brought them to the United States are working under long, unsafe, and exploited conditions for some of America's largest corporations. Never mind that the federal child labor provisions authorized by the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, also known as the child labor laws, were enacted to ensure that when minors do work, the work is safe and does not jeopardize their health, well-being, or educational opportunities, and it sets age limits for various types of work. And as we will shortly learn from our guest for this topic today, that act is being violated over and over again in 2023. 12-year-old roofers in Florida and Tennessee, underage slaughterhouse workers in Biden's home state, Delaware, and children sawing planks of wood on overnight shifts in South Dakota. The shame of this should be mind-boggling for the American people. But as we now begin interviewing today's guest, this is still the despicable reality of the lives of these minors now in the United States. Well, let's get to it. Our guest for this topic is Professor Sarah Rogerson, the director. She is of the Justice Center at Albany Law School, where she is also the faculty director of the Immigration Law Clinic, in which students represent immigrant victims of crime. Her scholarship addresses flaws in the administration of immigration laws and policy, including intersections with domestic violence and international law. Sarah Rogerson, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Unaccompanied immigrant children here in the United States are supposedly entitled to what is called special immigrant juvenile status and additional trafficking protections. But you've said that they must jump through hoops to get that kind of protection. Talk to us a bit about this.
Sure. So these were protections that were enacted, I guess I can say, early in this century now, but they came through the need to protect trafficking victims and really came from normative standpoint, this idea that unaccompanied minors are often subjected to human trafficking when they cross, make border crossings alone or go to a country where they don't have adults in charge of them while they're making their voyage. And I should say children and young adults, because under immigration law, the definition of a child is anyone under the age of 21 who is unmarried. So sometimes we have, you know, applicants who are between the ages of 18 and 21 also making this trip who qualify for this status. But it's rooted in this idea of protection of trafficking victims. There are a bunch of problems with it that have been well documented in the legal literature, but I'll highlight a few. One big problem is that it requires cooperation with state authorities, and that being the state family courts, to make a determination that it is not in the best interest of this child to be reunited with one or both parents, or that they can't be reunited with one or both parents due to abandonment, abuse, or neglect. And death, in New York State anyway, constitutes abandonment for the purpose of that law. So if your parents have died, that qualifies you for this status if you make the journey to the United States to try to survive. But often these folks have a relative in the United States. Maybe they have status, maybe they don't. An aunt or an uncle or someone else in their extended family who can look after them. And often that person is appointed to be a guardian in the state family court. But that's a whole process. And in some state courts, these young people age out of that process at the age of 18. So although they might qualify under immigration law at the age of 19, they can't get that predicate order if they've aged out of the state court system. So that's one big problem. The other big problem is that our family court system is a mess in lots of different ways. And so sometimes this process doesn't go the way that it should. Sometimes it depends judge by judge in the family court whether or not you'll be successful on this application. And without it, without that state court order, you cannot apply for the visa. So once they go through the family court process, they also have the immigration process. And if they are being actively removed from the United States, it's a different process than if they have entered and have not been detected by immigration authorities and are bringing themselves forward to seek protection. It's another separate involved process with the immigration authorities to try to get this visa through. And similarly, you know, under the Trump administration, we had a really terrifying moment where the Trump administration was interpreting New York law differently than New York law was, the New York judges were interpreting New York law. And the federal government sent us a notice of intent to deny about 35 to 40 of these kids' cases because they were reading the law differently than the state of New York. And that was political and targeted. But of all of the different vulnerable populations to target, it was particularly heinous that the Trump administration was going after unaccompanied kids. So we fought that, and we worked with others in New York State to fight that, and ultimately those cases were approved. But, you know, we're talking about a 3-5 year process in some of these cases. And that's assuming that these children find access to resources to tell them it exists in the first place. It's not like an unaccompanied minor whose last living relative passed away or who just lost a parent and has made this difficult journey to the United States is doing so because they know they can get protection. They're coming because they don't have another place to go. I've been working on these cases for years and years and years. The law was passed when I was a young civil rights attorney working in an immigration nonprofit in Dallas, Texas under the Bush administration. I have lots of vivid recollections of these cases and these stories that are often hard to put down. It's not a free pass by any stretch of the imagination.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host and former law partner, Jim Lafferty, on the Law and Disorder Show here. We're speaking with Professor Sarah Rogerson, who's an immigration law professor and expert. Sarah, it's hard to believe that the companies supplying products for some of this country's largest corporations like Ford or General Motors or Walmart, that they don't realize that they're taking advantage of these children who are unaccompanied, these underage children, and they're thereby violating the law. And what about the giant corporations that they supply products for? In short, do these suppliers not know their suppliers are exploiting child labor in the making of these products? And by the way, a follow-up, is it simply the case that child labor laws in our country are unpoliced, thereby allowing these supply companies to violate the law with little fear of detection?
Yeah, there are so many unanswered questions in those questions, right? It's very frustrating to have to continuously look at corporate oversight when we do have such what are supposed to be strong protections in the United States as compared to other countries, and certainly as compared to the countries from which these children are coming. So, you know, one problem is from the children's perspective, working at a tender age may not be a foreign concept to them. That might be actually normatively pretty standard in the country from which they are coming. It might not be, but in some cases it is. And so they're, in effect, thinking that they're just sort of doing what they're supposed to do to take care of their family, right? And certainly that can be the case more predominantly in agricultural settings, right? I'm here in upstate New York. I teach at Albany Law School. We have a lot of dairy farms. We have a lot of orchards. We have a lot of vineyards. And that's often the place where we see, typically I see the unaccompanied minors that are older, like between the ages of 16 to 21, who say, you know, like, in order to live and in order to support my family, I want to work in this job. And some of the employers provide housing. Sometimes it's substandard. We have a lot of good people in upstate New York working for farm workers' rights across the board, but including immigrant workers, and most notably our vulnerable immigrant workers of a younger age. So there are, depending on the setting, there are a lot of different things at play. But certainly, you know, the more recent stories that have come out about children working in large factories for behemoth corporations, it's deeply troubling that there aren't more controls in place, right? There are statements by corporate leaders that say things like, well, some of these kids have documents that say that they're older than they really are. But when you look at a child and you think that something might be amiss, rather than turning a blind eye and saying, well, the paper, I can copy this paper, put it in the file, and protect myself if an inspection comes around, you know, that's not good enough. These corporate practices really hurt other businesses that are lawfully employing immigrant workers generally, not children, but we have special visas for people who want to come here to work in certain industries, and that system is broken, surprise, surprise, because all of these immigration systems are broken and dated. But that system relies on employer transparency. And it's not sufficient for a major corporation to hide behind a mask of false documents or whatever a child may present in order to do what they think they have to do. And sometimes these children are paying off debts to the people that they or their family members entrusted to bring them here, right? That relationship can turn manipulative and violent very easily because of the power difference between the child and the adults. So there are so many factors at play that large corporations use all of these excuses to sort of distance themselves from responsibility. And it's on consumers and, you know, the free press that we still have in this country to expose those practices and to make and our federal government to make sure that they're taking care of these minors. Now, another big problem is that our federal government is not doing that, has not done that, and across the political spectrum has failed at caring for unaccompanied minors. This goes back to, it spans the last century plus. Children make their way here however they come, from Cuba, from Haiti, from other places that have been economically or politically fraught and dangerous for kids, sometimes explicitly dangerous for kids. And our country loses children. Our country claims to take care of them through the Department of Health and Human Services, but then fails to place them in appropriate homes or places them with people that are then exploitative. So it's a big, violent problem that unfortunately is borne by children in our country.
Oh, dear. Well, yes. And Professor Sarah Rogerson,
In that New York Times article that I referenced at the start of my introduction to the topic, there are numerous examples given of underage minors working long, long hours under brutally unsafe conditions and leaving them really unable after working under such conditions to go to school or if school, leaving them falling asleep at their desk, getting sick, and so forth. Does this square with your own experience in these matters? And if it does, could you tell us about some of the cases you've come across?
Yeah, some of the cases that I've dealt with are the kids in the older age range band between 16 to 18 years old who are trying to finish school and work to support themselves or family members back home. And it's a struggle. These kids also have difficulty with any sort of like self-transportation to be able to be where they need to be at the time that they need to be there. Never mind extracurricular activities. I mean, that's not even a consideration for these kids. They're usually putting in 14, 17 hour days, getting sleep where they can. And, you know, for some of them, they are doing remarkably well in school, all things considered. But for others, they simply, you know, can't prioritize school. And I know that that was the case for some of the children that were highlighted in the New York Times report as well. They just end their education prematurely in order to be able to pursue their immigration status and to send money back home. These applications, I should say, sometimes you can apply for a fee waiver, but other times it can be expensive even for children to come up with some things like the photographs that they need in order to submit their application to the government. And certainly sitting with a lawyer for, you know, the hours upon hours that are required in order to do this appropriately and get to court, sometimes two different courts if you're in state court and federal court and federal immigration court, that's a lot for a young person to handle and to be able to navigate. And so it takes an emotional toll. It takes a physical toll, certainly. And I've not had this happen to any of the kids that I've represented, but you know, it can take their lives ultimately, and that's not a system that we should be supporting in any way, shape, or form. But it seems to be one of those intractable problems in U.S. immigration law, and there are many. But this one really gets the attention of folks when there is a surge of unaccompanied minors. At the last surge in 2013, 2014, that's when I founded the Immigration Law Clinic at Albany Law School in order to help some of these kids that were coming into our region. But it's frustrating to see the pattern continue and to be exacerbated by multinational corporations that are profiting off of these children.
We're talking with immigration law professor Sarah Rogerson. Sarah, with respect to virtually all aspects of how the government of the United States has been responding to the admittedly huge flow of immigrants at our southern border, including unaccompanied minors, the claim is often heard that there are simply not enough federal employees and judges available to more quickly and properly process these people through the system, and that's why so many of the unaccompanied children are essentially lost in the system. In your opinion, is this the main or only reason why there's a massive exploitation of underage immigrant children working in violation of the child labor laws? Is this mainly a personnel shortage?
Absolutely not. So one thing to know is that that could be remedied easily in the budget process. It would not even be a stretch with existing resources to send more qualified judges to immigration officers to the border when surges occur. It's not politically popular, right? Because what people like to see is border enforcement, not border fluidity. But what is happening is border fluidity, whether people want to admit it or not. It will always happen because people move. That is a fact of being a human in the world, right? You know, in 50 years, in 100 years, it's quite possible that certain stretches along the U.S.-Mexico border might be completely uninhabitable. So then what's the conversation about these horrible laws that we have in place that are largely rooted in racism, okay? So the first immigration laws on the books in the United States explicitly excluded Chinese It was, the statute was called the Chinese Exclusion Act. So you there's no question about the basis of our immigration system being rooted in xenophobia and racism. And it hasn't gotten much better since then. But then with unaccompanied children, this also dates back to World War II, where one of the first executive actions ever taken by a president was after the war, not before, because before the war, there were groups that were advocating to bring Jewish children to the United States to avoid their inevitable fate. We knew we couldn't do much to save their parents, but we were hoping to be able to save some children. And there were women and others who organized to provide testimony to Congress to say, these children will never assimilate in this country because they're Jewish, was the subtext. And some of it was explicit. It's wild reading the congressional testimony notes from that time. Because these mothers actually actively lobbied Congress to ban children from coming over. We know what happened. Thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of children perished. And it was after that that we had our first presidential executive action to say, all right, I don't care if Congress isn't going to move on this. I'm bringing children over. This is a humanitarian crisis. This is unprecedented. We have to do this, right? But that's how bad it is. So that, like, if those are our starting points in the United States with respect to unaccompanied minors, like, it's hard to build from there. We haven't in the last century at all. There are stronger child labor laws in the United States, right? And that's been an improvement, but they haven't been nuanced enough to capture this group of kids. And we know that they're coming. We know what these patterns are at the border. They are predictable, often, usually. The additional problem with the Trump administration putting actively restrictionist policies in place, effectively closing the border and eviscerating asylum and refugee law, scoops up these special immigrant juveniles in that whole process as well. So Title 42, something called the MPP, the Migrant Protection Protocols, which never protected anyone. The effect of all of that was to have huge refugee camps at the southern border throughout the latter part of the Trump administration, which fueled cartels, the human trafficking crisis, and everything else. Not to be a complete pessimist, but if you layer on top of that the complete disinformation machine that constantly churns out information, not information, lies, saying that migrants who cross at irregular points of entry are fueling a fentanyl crisis, which is just blatantly false, because the fentanyl crisis is coming through border checkpoints and large caravans driven largely by United States citizens. But, you know, you get enough of these lies out there, and normatively it becomes, I called this in one article that I wrote about unaccompanied minors, the politics of fear. It's fear-based, reactionary policies to children, and it's persistent and astonishing.
Well, Professor Sarah Rogerson, what could be done, do you think, that would ease the problem that we're facing that you've described so well today?
Well, certainly beefing up support for civil legal services for immigration attorneys. I always hate to center attorneys in this conversation as opposed to the children themselves, but without an attorney, a child is far less likely to be able to achieve status in the country, right? With all of these, two attorneys really, sometimes three, a family court lawyer, an immigration lawyer, and sometimes if they've had some sort of encounter with law enforcement, they might need a criminal lawyer just to get them out with a clean record for, you know, minor traffic violations or different things that spiral or can spiral. And in immigration law, there are lots of benign criminal allegations that can really frustrate the special immigrant juvenile process. So, you know, making sure, a lot of people don't know that in the United States there is no guaranteed right to counsel if you're undocumented, if you're an immigrant to this country. There's no it's considered a civil law, and there's no right to counsel. There's a right to an attorney if you can find one, but there isn't, and there's a right to speak to your attorney if you have one, but there isn't like a guarantee that you will be represented. And the government is stacked. The judiciary is not independent. The judiciary is under the attorney general, which is part of the executive branch. There is no independent federal immigration bench. So the judge is in the attorney general's office. Shorthand, it's a lot more complicated than that, but you know, in the interest of time. And the prosecutors are representing the federal government. And then there's you. And sometimes we have 3, 4, 5-year-old kids sitting in those big chairs in immigration court alone. And there are immigration judges that have gone on the record saying that they think they can walk these kids through the process. And I don't believe that to be true, being a mother of two myself. So that, you know, making sure that kids have representation is a really important piece of this. At the border, something that would, you know, lift all boats, as they say, would be to staff up the humane side of immigration, not the ICE side, right? We've got the Department of Homeland Security has one of the largest budgets of any department in the whole country. We could find a way to carve out some of that to staff up humanitarian responses.
Professor Sarah Rogerson, unfortunately, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time. We're going to have to say goodbye. But before we do that, how can our listeners learn more about your work for immigrant justice and find out about your writings?
Well, you could go to the Albany Law School website, www.albanylaw.edu, and go to my faculty page, and a lot of it's listed there. There's also a place where people can go that they wouldn't necessarily know about called SSRN, the Social Science Research Network, ssrn.com, and you can look up not just me, but lots of other different scholars' work on this really important topic. There are a lot of other law professors who are laser-focused on this issue, and you can find their writings by typing special immigrant juvenile in the search box, and you can see all of the different things that folks have written and are in the process of writing that will be published or have been published in law review articles.
Well, Professor Sarah Rogerson, we certainly thank you for joining us here on Law and Disorder to bring this really tragic story to more and more people so that perhaps there'll be more awareness of it.
Well, and thank you for the platform and for bringing this to light. I appreciate it.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. You can subscribe to the TaxCast there, or you can email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Let me know what you think of the show. Okay, so on this month's TaxCast, the friend of organized crime and mafia networks is financial secrecy. Secrecy jurisdictions and tax havens have made it possible for mafias to progress from crossing physical borders with banknotes stuffed in suitcases to being able to pour unlimited amounts of money into the financial system. Dirty money in, clean money out. That money destabilizes economies and corrupts democracies, while mafias toxify societies using force and fear. But the problem is that financial secrecy and tax havens are also the friend of commerce, multinationals, and very wealthy, powerful people worldwide. That's why the obvious solution of opening up secrecy jurisdictions is so hard to achieve. I spend a lot of my time in Sicily. It's a place that's been limited for so long by the obsession people outside seem to have with the Sicilian Mafia, the Cosa Nostra. Actually, the Cosa Nostra, as it once was, has been in decline for years. There's been a lot of determination and bravery on the part of some Italian police and investigators. In my local town, the days when the judge had to have 24-hour guards with machine guns outside his house are long over. Actually, he got sent to Calabria, where the southern Italian mafias have become an even greater threat. Back on the island of Sicily, though, something monumental just happened in January 2023.
Obiettivo identificato, lo abbiamo catturato.
After 30 years on the run, Italy's most wanted Cosa Nostra fugitive has been arrested. Matteo Messina Denaro boasted he could fill a graveyard with all his victims. You can hear the applause of passers-by gathered on the street when he got arrested. Some of them are trying to hug the policeman. One of them's tearful.
Bravissimi, bravi, bravi.
Grazie, grazie, grazie.
Matteo Messina Denaro was sentenced in his absence for murders including those of anti-mafia judges Giovanni Falcone and Paolo Borsellino in the 90s. That was a real turning point for many Sicilians. It's a wound that goes deep to this day. Most squares in Sicily are named after those two judges. In my local town square, there's a huge billboard with a famous photo of the two of them together. Written above it, it says, Città contro tutte le mafie, city against all mafias. Back to the arrest of Matteo Messina Denaro.
It's wonderful news. It's been wonderful news that he was arrested. He has been a fugitive for 30 years. He was the last big bosses to be a fugitive.
This is Professor of Criminology and Organized Crime expert Federico Varese.
It's an amazing achievement. It was not easy to arrest him. The net was closing on him. People close to him had been arrested only a few months earlier. So you could somewhat imagine that this was coming, but it's a fantastic news. It's also symbolically very important because this man has been one of the most ruthless, violent, terrible killers in the history of the Sicilian Mafia. Of course, he murdered the women and children. He is one of the killers of Falcone. So it's the end of an era.
The end of an era for Cosa Nostra, I hope, compared to how it was in the past. But other mafia networks in southern Italy like the Camorra and Ndrangheta are still strong, still powerful and very dangerous. So if we look at the scale just of all of the Italian mafias, I mean, it's difficult to estimate these things, as I know from the Tax Justice Network's work. And the fact that transparency and financial transparency isn't there in so many places. But I've been looking at the estimated turnover of mafia business in Italy. According to the Bank of Italy, it's worth 2% of Italian GDP. That's about 38 billion euros a year. That's 104 million euros a day of dirty money washing through the system. I mean, can you speak to the scale and, you know, how big this is? Because 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but it really is.
Yeah, 2% is a lot, and the Bank of Italy is very reliable. So there have been other numbers floating around, like 7%. That's, I think, too much. It's really important to see how this money, this figure is constructed. There is a lot of confusion over this, because obviously what the mafia does, it extorts or protects, depending on the point of view, businesses. So businesses pay a cut of their profit to the organization, mainly in Western Sicily, where the mafia is most rooted. And so we have to distinguish the business from the mafia income. So the business remains independent and makes money. But there is also often a tendency to confuse the turnover of the business with the profit of the business, with the profit of the mafia. And so it's very, very hard to construct meaningful estimates. You can say that the Syrian mafia is certainly in decline, partly because of this massive pressure from the police, and also because they have left the drugs train. So they are not anymore involved in drugs as they used to be. Now, you can estimate the number of crime families which are in Western Sicily, and some of them also in Eastern Sicily, and this is a number around 80. And the estimate of the membership is between 1,000 and 400 made members. So you can work out from that. But of course, not everybody makes all that much money. I mean, some are soldiers in the organization who are probably just scraping through, and some, of course, the bosses make much more. So it's very hard to put a number to that. Certainly, the Bank of Italy is a reliable source. Another way to think about this is that there is an office, procurator's office in Palermo, which is responsible for managing properties that are confiscated by from people who are connected to the mafia, not necessarily mafia members, but also people connected to the mafia. So, again, you can argue that maybe these confiscations happen very easily, but they estimate to have confiscated a third of the value of the Sicilian economy, so it's a lot of money. That would include items confiscated from people who are connected to the mafia, but not necessarily in the mafia. So this also could be people who just pay protection money, which of course is illegal in Italy.
So you can see what a huge effect Cosa Nostra has had in Sicily all these years. As Professor Varese's work has shown, Cosa Nostra tends to stay relatively local, where they can maintain the tightest control with people they trust. But one of their favourite jurisdictions to launder money is in nearby Malta. Just one investigation not so long ago discovered people with links to Cosa Nostra were generating 14 million euros a month through illegal online gaming there. Some of that cash generated was being reinvested in legitimate businesses. But we'll get back to Malta in a minute. This is journalist Stefano Vergine.
What we know for sure is that over the last years, Italian authorities seized around 4 billion euros that allegedly belongs to Messina Denaro. It's money that Messina Denaro invested through a number of his affiliates in legal businesses like supermarkets, wind farms, tourism companies, and also a lot of works of art. These assets were all in Italy, mainly in Sicily. The investments, of course, were not done by him. They were done by people close to him. But of course, this might not be the whole wealth belonging to Messina Denaro. So where could be the rest of his money? And for sure, we know that the global financial system provides a number of tools that help criminal organizations invest money. I'm thinking especially about tax havens and countries that guarantee the anonymity to beneficial owners of companies and of bank account holders. I'm thinking about Switzerland, for example, which borders Italy. Until a few years ago, bank secrecy was completely in place in Switzerland. And that means that if an Italian, for example, went to a Swiss bank with a bag full of cash, this person could deposit the money and no one would ever know this in Italy, neither judicial authorities. Now things have partially changed and Switzerland started to exchange data of account holders with the authorities of countries that are part of the OECD. Still, hiding money, however, is possible, and there are many places in the world that allow this to happen, officially or unofficially. One way is, for example, by using offshore companies linked to bank accounts that are based in a country where authorities don't actually check properly who their client is. Let me mention some examples that I found out in my job. In 2016, on the magazine L'Espresso, along with a group of colleagues, part of ICIJ, we work on the Panama Papers, and we found out the names of dozens of offshore companies managed by a number of trusted men of mafia leaders. I'm talking about people like the Graviano brothers, Salvatore Riina, Bernardo Provenzano, who have been the absolute leaders of the Sicilian mafia, the so-called Cosa Nostra. They were all sentenced to life imprisonment. In one case, for example, we revealed offshore companies doing business in Africa with gold and diamond mines. These companies, based mostly in the British Virgin Islands, were owned by the sons of Vito Palazzolo. We're talking about mafia organizations that are based on familiar ties. It's their strength. So Palazzolo was sentenced for being one of the biggest money launderers of Cosa Nostra when the mafia organization was led by Totò Riina. We're talking about the 90s. And its main business was trafficking heroin around the world. Palazzolo was sentenced for mafia back in the 80s, but the public didn't know about it, these offshore companies owned by his sons, until we revealed them in 2016. And this means that in the British Virgin Islands, no one raised a red flag on these companies, although the shareholders were sons of one of the biggest money launderers of Cosa Nostra. There are a number of cases like this. And in the Malta files, we also find cases like this. And this show that you don't necessarily have to go that far. You don't have to go to the Caribbean. You can stay close to Italy and go to Malta. In 2017, we revealed that some mafia organizations opened companies in the island. I'm talking about Sicilian Mafia, Camorra, and 'Ndrangheta, the Calabrian Mafia. For example, we found a company based in Malta whose director was the heir of an important mafia clan based in Calabria, the so-called 'Ndrangheta. The family is a big family specialized in cocaine trafficking with the South American cartels. So this is another example that shows how easy it can be for a criminal organization to open a company. Why is that? Even in countries where beneficial owners are not secret and where authorities officially collaborate with other countries, this is the case of Malta, for example, many banks and financial authorities don't really care about who their customers are as long as they bring money in. This is, I think, what actually helps criminal organizations to invest money overseas.
And sometimes the best investigations that have given us the most information were only because this information was leaked, right? And not because it's actually possible for somebody like you, sometimes a journalist, to actually get behind that wall of secrecy, to be able to report on who's behind a particular crime or a company involved in a crime, right?
That's true. I mean, most of the times, yes, the best investigations are coming from a leak or let's say from an internal source. It doesn't have to be a huge leak like Panama Papers, which was a very good investigation and brought a lot of results. But still, yes, one way is to have a police source that is telling you things that have been already uncovered. The other way is to have an internal source or a whistleblower that can bring a lot of data or data concerning his company's specific field of activity.
Yeah, otherwise it's like coming up against a brick wall. Let's have a look at Malta as one of the favourite jurisdictions for Cosa Nostra money. The harm Malta's done to itself and its people because of its oversized financial sector and offshore secrecy services is obvious. It's not exaggerating to say it's become a criminal state. Dirty money has undone the rule of law there, almost every check and balance. But it doesn't stop there, because once dirty money's gone into their financial system, it washes into the global economy too. This is Kevin Kassar. He's a surgeon in Malta who's spoken out about how Malta's become a mafia paradise.
Malta is just 60 miles south of Sicily. We can actually see Mount Etna on a clear day. So we are extremely close. We have regular ferries going across, which takes about just 2 hours by ferry. If you take a plane, it takes you 20 minutes to get to Sicily. The big advantage to to mafiosi and other people in organized crime in Sicily is that Malta joined the European Union. And we're also, of course, we've got the euro, and we're part of Schengen, so there is free movement. So it's extremely easy to get in and out of Malta and into Europe and from Sicily into Malta with very little or no checks at all. In addition to that, Malta is the tiniest country in the European Union, which means that some of these criminal organizations have a turnover every year, which is basically the size of our economy. And therefore, in a small place like this, it is extremely easy to pay your way into whatever position you want to get to.
Dirty money is also what led to the murder of Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia to shut down her investigations and the mess the police made of that case and allegations about politicians connected to it tell you everything about the state of justice in Malta. And just as telling, not long ago in Malta, the post of Deputy Police Commissioner became vacant. No one applied for it, and for me that speaks very strongly about what kind of a failed state Malta actually is.
Yeah, it definitely is a failed state. And the problem is that the Prime Minister has almost absolute powers. So the Prime Minister appoints a police commissioner. The problem with that is that people who were deeply involved in gross corruption, who were involved in illegalities, who were close to the Prime Minister, were never prosecuted. So we have, for example, magisterial inquiries related to Pilatus Bank, for example, which specifically said that the chairman of Pilatus Bank, which is this money laundering enterprise for the Azerbaijanis and for people close to former Prime Minister Joseph Muscat, should be prosecuted. This man has never been prosecuted. We had another magisterial inquiry which looked into allegations that one of these secret financial structures set up by Mossack Fonseca belongs to the Prime Minister's wife, former Prime Minister Joseph Muscat, that is. And one of the accountants involved, who was part of the same company that was working very closely with the Prime Minister, the conclusions of the inquiry was that this man should be prosecuted for perjury. This man was never prosecuted. So we have a state of impunity, which was one of the main conclusions of the Daphne Caruana Galizia inquiry. So in answer to your question, why do people not want to join the police force in any, even almost at the lowest levels, let alone at the higher echelons? And the reason is that this is a completely corrupt institution. The police commissioner himself was finally removed when there was an order by the court that he should be investigated. That was months, if not years ago. No action has been taken against the former police commissioner. There's also huge pressure, of course, on people who are in the police force who try to do their job. So we have had people, for example, like a chap who was investigating these people close to politicians and politicians themselves, who was basically hounded out of the force, and he's now suing the government for discrimination and for basically not reintegrating him into the police force. We had another gentleman who was in the FIAU, that's the Financial Investigative Authority, who was basically kicked out when he started to work on these cases of corruption involving politicians. So it's no surprise that nobody wants to get into a police force like that.
No surprise at all.
We live in a country where we've had several bombings, people killed with car bombs, the same type of bombs that killed Borsellino and Falcone. In a small country like this, where you have bombs exploding and killing people, none of those bombings has been solved. The only one that has partially been solved is the Caruana Galizia bombing, and that's because of the involvement of the FBI. So can you imagine a small country like ours, where we have multiple people killed from car bombings, and nobody ever arraigned? And I tell you possibly why. Because the people who are now under arrest, finally, the Maksar brothers, they were clients of our current Prime Minister. So our current Prime Minister was the lawyer defending the Maksar brothers. So this is the sort of network that we have, which is, to me, it is far worse than what is happening in Sicily. because in Sicily there is some rule of law. The state is trying to protect the citizens. In this country, our governments, our authorities, our institutions, the police, are all part of this criminal network.
So, however bad things have been and can be in Sicily, Malta is a classic captured state because of its big financial secrecy sector. And looking the other way when it comes to criminal money coming in extends to everything. It undermines fair public procurement in the public interest, which Sicilians know all about too. All of this erodes people's trust in the state to provide for their needs. Kevin Casua, as a surgeon, has seen this for himself only too plainly in Malta.
We are really in dire straits because half of our health service was sold off to this company. They, of course, had absolutely no intention of improving the health service at all. And people in the health service, of course, can easily recognize a scam because you don't sell half the health service to somebody who's never run a clinic, let alone a hospital. Besides, later on, we found out that the government entered into a secret memorandum of understanding with this group of businessmen before the actually request for proposals by government was made. So they had already identified and decided who was going to run this enterprise. Of course, after 2 years and a lot of promises that they were going to build a new hospital, that they were going to revitalize an old hospital and develop more services, they promised that they would build another hospital in Gozo, they promised they would build a medical school in Gozo, they promised they would increase jobs, they promised they would increase beds. None of this happened. So from our point of view, what we've seen is when COVID struck and we needed more beds, who are deprived of those beds? Today, we are still lacking those beds and we are ending up, for example, changing a staff canteen into a ward. We're still using a staff canteen for a ward. So the reality of the situation in practice is that giving out this concession, as it was called, to these people has basically seriously eroded the quality of care that we can offer our patients. And of course, we've lost millions. So these millions, nobody really knows where they've gone. The National Audit Office have published 3 separate reports. They're damning reports. They highlight that this was a scam from start to finish. There has been no action taken against any of the people involved. This is 4 billion euros. Can you imagine in a small country like ours?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think my question to you then is, I think that none of the things that you're describing could happen without financial secrecy. That's been such a central part of the economy there in Malta. And that's having a really bad effect, not just on people in Malta, but people in Sicily, people in Italy, people everywhere in the world, because it's all connected. So my question is, as you know, we campaign against financial secrecy. We want the real beneficial owners of companies to be declared publicly, that there should be public registries, that there's full financial transparency in all areas. So what effect would full financial transparency on a place like Malta be, do you think?
I think this is absolutely crucial. So half our public health service was sold to a company and no single Maltese person actually knew the ultimate beneficial owner of the company behind this. It was so opaque, the structures upon structures were impossible. So we were being told as citizens that half our health service was being sold to somebody and we didn't even know who this somebody was. So, you know, that is one big problem. But the truth is that leading our government, which is really a party that still has a massive support base in this country, are people who have been working tirelessly to make financial structures even more opaque. We've recently had the Minister of the Economy, who's made it even more difficult for citizens to identify who is the ultimate beneficial owner of companies which are registered in this country. You can't know who they are. There's been about 10,000 companies that have been suddenly scrubbed off the Malta Business Registry. So we can't go back historically once we find out that these companies were involved in illicit activity and find out who they were. So it is extremely difficult for journalists to do their job. It's almost impossible to get clear answers. This is a mafia state. This is a state captured by a small group of people who are making millions, who are becoming obscenely wealthy, and who are draining the funds of this country for their own personal gain. And that's not something I am saying. It's something that the U.S. State Department has said. And this is why a former minister of energy and the chief of staff of the former prime minister can't get into the United States as we speak.
Journalist Stefano Vergine again.
I think the main problem is the system, financial system, that allows these kind of things. Because, for example, if you have foreign companies investing in Italy, but you are not able to find out who the beneficial owners are, well, that's an issue. And you can't do much from an Italian point of view. So I think this is the biggest problem.
And again, the problem isn't contained in one part of the world. The weak links in each jurisdiction interconnect and they're easy to exploit. Professor Varese again.
I think it's obvious that you need to know who is the ultimate beneficiary of shell companies or trusts. And I think the kind of the regulations we see in London, in which you can own a company which is owned by another company, and you can easily create a company with fake names, or you have these addresses in London which have thousands and thousands of companies in one address. I think all of that is facilitating massive criminal money transfers. So I think that, I think, is crazy.
And this is also where it gets politically tricky. No jurisdiction has clean hands, and they're all slow to cast stones because they're all living in glass houses. But Malta has become such a threat to the EU for various reasons. The EU Commission's been monitoring events there. It's done a number of reports on what's going wrong. So, Kevin, what should the European Parliament, the Commission, be doing to help tackle corruption in Malta, do you think?
A lot of people looked towards the European Union to act as, if you like, a protector for the people from its own government. Sadly, a lot of people here feel very let down by the European Union. The European Union has been very weak. The reality is that if Europe wanted to control this country, they could, by withholding funds. There are hundreds of millions coming from Europe. So the first thing that Europe should do is that not simply write reports, but it must impose clear requirements. It should immediately withhold funds until all the measures have been taken to implement proper rule of law, to implement proper checks and balances, and to ensure that none of the money that is coming from Europe is diverted into criminal organizations, criminal activity, and rampant corruption. But of course, Europe won't do that because it will appear to be picking on a small state when it has much bigger problems such as, you know, Hungary and Poland. But the truth is that, as was done with the case of Hungary, changes will only come if there is severe imposition and restriction of funds to this country.
The EU should take action. The trouble is the EU does things like maintain a ridiculous black and grey list system of jurisdictions it says are non-cooperative for tax purposes and they need to improve governance in those areas. So with these lists, it doesn't list any EU nations, no matter what they do. So it needs really to face up to its own failings. Professor Varese again.
The social and political cost of the existence of the mafia is massive, that's for sure. I mean, there is more than just the economic value, right? I mean, the economic value is important, but they interfere in the political process. They interfere in the economic development of the island. And of course, they generate fear and violence, although not necessarily a lot of murders. The fear that they generate is massive. And also they generate a distrust, you know, in the Italian state and among people themselves. As for the Sicilian mafia, it's fair to say that the Sicilian mafia And even the arrest of Matteo Messina Denaro is not going to disappear because of the arrest of one person. And yes, it is under huge police pressure. But unfortunately, the mafia is still there. And now all the bosses are in jail and new bosses will come up. So there's really a question for Italy to ask what really we need to do to defeat once and for all the Sicilian mafia. And that is to regain the trust of the people in Sicily who distrust greatly the Italian state. And tax evasion is not just a feature of the mafia, it's a feature of Italy in general. So I think the Italian state has to, and the Italian political class, has to ask big questions of why the mafia is still not being eliminated. The mafia is not just a criminal phenomenon linked to money laundering. It's a political, social, and economic phenomenon which is deeply rooted in the lack of trust in an Italian state which is extremely inefficient. Only yesterday I read about a case in a civil court that took 20 years to be settled. 20 years. Imagine if you are a business. And so that generates a demand for the mafia. And so business people turn to the mafia to settle disputes, even legal disputes. And then, of course, the mafia gets a foothold in the legal economy. They are paid for these services, and then they launder them in the local economy. And so that, is, to me, is the root cause of the mafia, a deeply inefficient state and a state that is not trusted by the people. A lot of the job the mafia does is involved in construction. You know, they organize construction bids, and so making it more transparent the way construction contracts are allocated is very important, and possibly to centralize more the bids as opposed to keep them local, because at the local level the mafia is extremely powerful. So I think tackling the money the mafia makes is certainly important, and we need to do that, but in itself it may not be enough.
No, definitely not. I've seen exactly what you're talking about in Sicily, where, you know, somebody has something stolen and they don't go to the police, they go to where they can receive a service. And I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that's the right way or it's the way they prefer, but it's the way that they use often, you know, not all people, but many people. And then it's so important that a tax system must be accountable, and it's part of building trust with people. So how do you use a tax system to build trust, which is understandably gone in a place where, to differing extents in Sicily, the state is really not in evidence, it's not really present in people's lives?
Yeah, a simple, straightforward and fair tax system is crucial. And in the Italian case, you have a lot of exceptions, a lot of people, a lot of subgroups that don't pay taxes. And so that generates a sense of unfairness and privilege that there are. There are small groups of well-connected and well-organized groups in society and in the economy who can avoid paying taxes. So there is the overwhelming burden of taxes is paid in Italy by people who are employed by the state, like teachers or professors or nurses. And so it gives you the impression that there is a section of society that overwhelmingly pays taxes and cannot avoid paying them, and a section of society which doesn't pay taxes. So I totally agree. I think that is one of the key elements to making the state more efficient, together with, of course, the justice system, especially the civil court system. Ultimately, you need a functioning state, a state that functions and is, and also is not too complicated. So transparency, efficiency, and justice carried out quickly is crucial to regain trust in the state. So to me, this is absolutely crucial if we want to tackle the deep-rooted reasons. So ultimately, we need the state reform in all its parts so that you have an efficient provision of goods and services, including welfare state, which is obviously not working very well. Imagine that in Sicily, roads are like not really working across the island, and they often break down, so you cannot cross the island sometimes because there is an accident in the highway.
Oh yeah, definitely. Near my town in Sicily, there was a road that was closed off for years and years, and we all had to go on a crazy long diversion because they didn't fix it for so long. Sometimes Sicilians themselves just get together and fix their own roads. I mean, staff who work in care homes looking after the elderly go on strike sometimes because they haven't been paid for months. The local rubbish collection that people pay taxes for just stops. Once it happened for months, people were burning the rubbish to keep the rats and the stray dogs away. Then they introduced another local ring-fenced rubbish tax. I mean, imagine how people feel when that stops working. I mean, people will believe and go for anything that seems to work in their lives.
Yes, I don't think it's a matter necessarily of increasing expenditures. I think it's a matter of spending better what we already spend and really restructuring the state. But it really requires the fight against entrenched special interests. So it's costly politically, but the problem with the system will never be solved by purely arresting people and military and police forces, though they are extremely important, of course, because these people have to be arrested, like Messina Denaro, and they have been found guilty in court. So obviously that has to be done. And I would say investigations are actually quite efficient and quite thorough. But everything else is not. And until everything else is tackled and becomes a genuine national emergency for the first time, really, then I think the problem of the mafia will stay with us. And then, yes, they will launder their money, they will interfere with politics, they will interfere with the local economy, they will generate fear and further distrust in the state.
So much of this comes down to the failure to establish a social and economic model based on fundamental rights. Central to that is a transparent, fair and accountable tax and financial system. Without a system like that, a predatory one will form that generates injustices, inequalities and democratic inadequacies where criminal opportunities for profit and power flourish and spread. The Matteo Messina Denaros of this world can't enjoy the levels of wealth they do without these weak links of secrecy in our global financial system. As I say, some of those weak links also serve commerce and other rich and powerful people. That's why public registries of the real owners of companies, trusts and foundations are so important. Failure to properly collect, verify and publish this information should mean fines and prosecutions. After years of pressure from anti-corruption campaigners, the European Union did finally take action to introduce a requirement for European countries to implement public registers of the beneficial ownership information of companies. But a recent ruling from the European Court of Justice has reversed 10 years of progress. As a result, many leading European tax havens have once more restricted access. The winners from all this are the Matteo Messina Denaros of this world and their professional enablers, unscrupulous lawyers, accountants, wealth managers and bankers. That's it for this edition of the TaxCast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.